You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, I'm Sam Hammond from the Niskanen Center.
I'm Maha Rafiatel from the Copenhagen Business School.
So a little background, me and Maha recorded a dialogue almost 9 years ago, maybe off 2 months, back when the Blogging Heads platform was doing this experiment where they brought in commentators to do episodes. I think since then the files have been lost to content management system switches and stuff like that, but I reached out and I thought it'd be cool to do a kind of retrospective now that we're, you know, 9 years out from that. At the time, I was only 17. Maha was just recently out of college, and I was living in Canada and jealous of people I see on Blogging Heads who get to work and talk about public policy every day. So, and now I'm in DC working and talking about public policy every day. And Maha has her own story out of college. So Maha, can you tell us where you are now?
Sure. So yeah, I think when we did it, I was pretty recently out of college. I'm trying to remember exactly when it was. I was living in New York. I was working as a freelance journalist, writing mostly about kind of business and economic policy topics, and trying to kind of like break in to some extent. And again, I think kind of learned a lot from watching Blogging Heads, and then probably later connecting with some of the people that I knew and I watched on Twitter, and that I think probably is actually how I ended up sort of building a network. And then I kind of a few years later after that made a sort of transition out of journalism and went and did a PhD, wanted to get into some more depth basically on some topics that I'd been writing about as a journalist. And I've just started a postdoctoral fellowship at the Copenhagen Business School, which is a very cool place that does research about business, but intersecting between business and other kind of social science disciplines. So you have people doing anthropology about business, people doing history about business, people doing political science about business, and so on. And that's my story, I guess.
It's very cool. I remember back in 2009, some guy named Will Wilkinson did a Blogging Heads episode, and I was such a big fan of his because I was like a libertarian with sort of heterodox libertarian views that wasn't sort of mainstream libertarian, and just really liked Will's writing. And now flash forward, I work at the Niskanen Center where Will Wilkinson's the vice president, and we actually share an apartment in D.C. So one thing that I have to take some meta commentary on Blogging Heads itself, like Blogging Heads has been a kind of institution in a way where it's never really, it's always been a kind of behind the scenes thing, or, you know, it hasn't really broken in the mainstream, but there's so many interesting people that Blogging Heads will have on, prominent people. But by being in the shadows, it's sort of had like a level of quality to discussion that other formats don't have. We were talking about, like, we both came from the comment section, and we were talking about before recording that how much better those comment sections are compared to the comment sections you have today.
I mean, I wonder if that's stayed. I mean, I have to confess that, especially after kind of transitioning out of journalism, because I did a couple of those commenter ones besides the one that I did with you. You know, once I kind of transitioned into academia, life kind of got busy enough that I haven't spent a lot of time in the comments in a long time. And I wonder, over all of the like CMS changes that they've had, like whether that's changed. And I also know that there was a period, I think, when Blogging Heads videos, I don't know if this is still true, were being excerpted on the New York Times website in the opinion section. And like, I wonder to what extent kind of like feeding into more general media has had an impact on the way that kind of commenter culture worked. But I do remember that at the time it was almost like a late hangover of kind of late 90s, early 2000s, like forum culture, right, where you could have like very substantive conversations. And, you know, I'm sort of just the age where like part of my early internet experience would have been that. So it felt very, very familiar to me, and almost like it was lasting into the social media era in some way that it seemed unexpected. And I'm not, you know, 100% sure. I don't know how well that's kind of survived. But you saying that you're living with Will, that's hilarious, because I think there was a Blogging Heads video, somebody in the comments now will correct me, many, many years ago, that involved like a couple of Blogging Heads people having a discussion while cooking in somebody's apartment.
I don't remember that, but I take your word.
And I want to say, this is bad because I want to say that Megan McArdle was in it, but I couldn't tell you who the other people were.
Megan is loves to cook.
Yes, no, and posts in addition to her stuff that's like about economics and policy and whatever things about food. So that's why I'm pretty sure that she was one of them. But it just reminded me of that because in those early days, I think it also was very much the case that like there were a very small number of people who wrote political blogs in DC. They all knew each other, whatever their politics were. And so there was also like a little like window into that. And I do remember as a young person kind of coming into the world of kind of writing about policy in some way, that's like to see this kind of really clubby thing taking place was both very appealing, but also a little weird.
So before we fall totally beyond the event horizon of nostalgia, what we're talking about today, I mean, it kind of feeds out of some of our experiences. So like I also did a couple dialogues back then. One of them was on sort of, I think the title of it was the demerits of libertarianism, where I, you know, the flaws I saw in libertarianism. And another one was, I think the one we did on environmentalism, and kind of taking a shallow approach to the environment where, you know, you tax externalities as opposed to, you know, have this deep ecology approach. I think that was the topic we talked about. Flash forward, and the Niskanen Center where I work, we're like ex-Cato people who are libertarian at heart, but like think it, libertarianism has lost some of its like more liberal roots as opposed to you know, non-aggression principle bases, and also we were founded to deal with, you know, climate change and talk about carbon taxes as a market-based approach. So I think it's interesting how consistent that has been, and the sort of some of the contemporary debates that are going on now with the Democratic Party as people jockey for, you know, potential presidential runs. There's this tilt, at least rhetorically, towards socialism, right? And it's not necessarily clear that this word has any bearing on what socialism is per se, as opposed to just being a more rhetorically forceful way of talking about traditional progressive causes. And, you know, one of the things that Will wrote recently was responding to a piece by Kevin Williamson, which we'll provide links to. And Williamson, I think the title of the piece was Socialism is the New Libertarianism. And the point he was making is, well, you know, all these socialists like Ocasio-Cortez or Bernie Sanders, when they're talking about, you know, Denmark as being their model, they're missing the fact that, you know, the Nordic model is far more free market than they realize, far more, you know, Sweden has a voucher system, and he talks about how they have, you know, privatized a bunch of their, you know, public utilities and stuff like that. And it's interesting because the very same day Will published a piece responding to this, and Will's piece was sort of building on Kevin's piece, saying, well, yeah, this is more semantical, and socialism and capitalism is kind of a false dichotomy. A lot of the things that social democrats want, and, you know, there's a horseshoe that wraps around and kind of meets to where the things that more radical libertarians want, partly because there is this complementarity between social welfare policy and liberalized markets, because, you know, liberal markets disrupt people's lives. Competition is creative and destructive at the same time, and you need kind of safety nets to secure buy-in and make sure everyone is winning from that. So, you know, but the irony was, the exact same day, Elizabeth Warren released her proposal, a new bill called the American the Corporate Responsibility Act, or something like that. And the point of the act was to, it had many parts, but one of the facets was you know, adopting a co-determination model of corporate governance where big companies would have to appoint, the 40% of their board of directors would be appointed by employees, essentially, and they'd have to get a federal charter. And Kevin Williamson wrote a piece the same day. I think the title of that one was Elizabeth Warren's Batty Plan to Nationalize the Economy. And the upshot was, Warren has veered farther left than Bernie or Ocasio-Cortez in embracing a form of socialism that is going to, you know, make every major corporation a kind of national corporation. And the confusing bit about it was, and a lot of people pointed out later, is, you know, Warren's model for that was the German system of co-determination, the Danish system of co-determination. Sweden has a more relaxed version of it. And so it was like this whiplash where you go from saying, oh, Sweden and Germany and the Nordic countries are hyper free market, you silly Democrats. And the very next day saying, holy shit, Elizabeth Warren is going to turn us into a socialist dystopia.
So do you want me to just kind of jump in? I mean,
one thing I was going to say is, like, you're an American living not just in Europe, but you're in Copenhagen.
Yep.
How are you faring under the socialist dystopia?
Right. It's very obviously not a socialist country, right? And I think that, and it is one of the real frustrations of being, like, an American living anywhere in Europe. And I, you know, spent 5 years in the UK. That's where I did my PhD. And I mean, first, the first part of it is, of course, that, like, there is this rhetorical thing where, you know, sort of everything that's kind of left of the center left in American politics gets called socialist. And to some extent, I think that both that that's really clumsy and crude from the people who do it as an accusation, but also that, like, part and understandably, but it's kind of frustrating, lots of, like, American progressives, whether they're people who actually would identify in a real way as socialists or whether they're people who really are broadly kind of social democrats, have kind of gone, you know what, if you're just going to call everything socialist, fine, I'm a socialist, forget it. It's like a way to kind of appropriate an insult as a badge and try and convert its power in some way. And I kind of understand why people are doing that, but it's still kind of irritating because it's so nonspecific. So, I mean, that's the first part, is clearly these proposals aren't really socialist. And even something specifically what we're talking about, co-determination, you know, is not, like, doesn't have any element of state ownership of the means of production, right? It's not about that at all. It's a sort of a form of kind of forced soft cooperative ownership, but not really, because labor gets votes on the board. They don't get ownership shares, right? It's kind of a different thing. And we can talk more about the proposal in a second. But the other thing is also that I see both kind of proponents and critics of more progressive policy in the US that might be, like, inspired by things that exist in Europe, collapsing the differences between all of these different countries in ways that, like, you know, so we talk about, like, the Nordic model, and there is a Nordic model, but, you know, within the Nordic countries, the only country where there's real state ownership of, like, meaningful state ownership of kind of economic resources is Norway. And that's because Norway had a fossil fuel industry and they were able to convert that essentially into a wealth fund, which they then used to kind of buy stuff up. So that in Norway, you do really have government ownership of, you know, not a huge amount of business, but a significant share. You don't really have that even in other Nordic countries. So I think there's more, like, variety. You know, Europe is a big place. It has almost 30 countries in it. That's within the European Union. And then obviously there's lots of countries that aren't members. And I do think that American political discourse about this does tend to collapse not only, you know, sort of like everything into these two categories, socialism and capitalism, when there are lots of other models that exist in between, but then also the differences within those blocks in a crude sort of way that makes it hard to kind of talk about whether the policies work or not, because, you know, the proposals that she's got, that Warren has, is not quite as strong as the German version. It's probably actually closer to kind of the Swedish milder threshold. And yet the debate is going to want to draw on examples from all of those countries, in terms of evaluating whether the proposal would work. And there's something like the academic in me is kind of going, ah, that's apples to oranges. Don't do that. It's bad. those are the things I think that I find kind of vexing about it.
Yeah. I mean, I really value like a varieties of capitalism kind of approach. Where...
I was going to suggest, yeah, that we kind of talk about that. Cause I do think that that's like, I mean, it's very like academics use it all the time, but I don't know how, to what extent that framework is known. So do you want me to do
I'll just give a couple cents of thoughts here. Like, I love America. Obviously I moved here from Canada. But there is this like epic parochialism to America, which is partly, you know, in a factor of its just pure size and separation by oceans from other countries' experiences and its sense of exceptionalism. And that's partly why I like America. But it does lead to a kind of sense of the American model is quote unquote natural or like a fait accompli, and viewing slight alterations to the rules of the game as not just, you know, another way of doing things, but in some way more interventionist or, you know, I think part of this is the conservative movement back. They kind of painted themselves into a corner where, you know, because of the need to have like a strong anti-communist rhetoric throughout the 20th century, and post-Reagan, the Reagan Revolution is like, they've come to define socialism as like redistribution, sharing the wealth, when in many ways, like taxing and transferring post hoc is like one of the least interventionist ways you can, you know, try to equalize outcomes in society. If you know, there are more radical proposals out there. You mentioned, you know, co-determination is kind of a quasi cooperative model. You know, if you really read the manifesto of the Democratic Socialists for America, they want to, you know, abolish all corporations and replace them with either state-owned enterprises or, right, you know, worker-run cooperatives, which would be, you know, a more, like that's getting into the firmware of the economy in the way that taxing
is. Right. So like, and that is democratic socialism, right? Like, I mean, I do think the manifesto represents the label. I just think there are definitely people I know who are kind of like identifying themselves with that organization because they're frustrated with the Democratic Party, who don't necessarily kind of subscribe to all of that. I think you're right about the kind of Cold War like component of where American political discourse got to be this way about these terms. But then I also think that like all through the first half of the 20th century, the American economy ran on a pretty high level of taxation and redistribution, like most of the, you know, developed economies did. A lot of this has to do with, you know, I mean, a policy shift that took place across the kind of developed West in the 1970s and 1980s to move to like a less regulated, more financialized kind of model of market capitalism. It just, that shift was much, much more dramatic in the U.S. than it was in like any of its peer countries. So that a sort of divergence opened up. Mm-hmm. And at that point, in part, I think because of the way that like Cold War rhetoric had seeped into the American psyche, Americans, and not just like American individuals, but like to some extent experts and academics, began to start referring to these very capitalist, just differently capitalist countries in Western Europe as though they were sort of like somewhere between capitalism and socialism or flirting with socialism or whatever. And varieties of capitalism is a framework that develops in the 90s very much in response to that. To say, if you're going to talk about the institutional differences between the U.S. and Europe, and of course you should be acknowledging these as different ways to be a capitalist society. And it, you know, I use it as a teaching tool sometimes, and I do find it's kind of helpful with undergraduates. It's not something that I've ever really used in my research. I think it has its limitations, but I think it is helpful as a way of kind of clarifying those terms. Because, yeah, I mean, I do think that kind of post hoc tax and transfer, like, I don't see that as making any real fundamental change to, like, the rights of private property, the ability of people to, like, own businesses and make money and so on. And I think you would need to be making interventions in those to be doing something that would really qualify as socialist.
Right. Yeah, it's a point I make. I have a paper that came out in May called The Free Market Welfare State, where I tried to sort of, like, talk about social insurance and the social insurance state as sort of a next evolution of really deeply liberal principles of like cooperative, you know, systems of cooperation that, you know, build buy-in and like a kind of social contractarian view of liberalism that says, look, the trade-off in, let's take Denmark as an example, the trade-off of being a small open economy where, you know, we're deeply integrated in international trade and globalization is that at any point in time, trade winds can shift and you will find yourself unemployed. And there's two ways to approach that, right? You can protect the job or you can protect the income of the person, right? And there's a more sort of reactionary model, which I think is common to both like the more genuinely socialist left that wants to sort of, you know, unionize the, there's a recent article saying that Marriott was, the Marriott, the hotel chain is replacing or thinking about replacing their front desk workers with an Alexa type service. And, so you can check in with the robot and the, I guess the hospitality workers there are trying to get a influence at the ground level to, you know, secure their jobs. And that's a more, that doesn't happen in Denmark because Denmark can't afford to, you know, be sclerotic, because they are so integrated and they depend on, you know, the productivity of the country and Denmark and Norway and Sweden. They're like some of the most productive on like a per capita basis countries in the world. They depend on that productivity to afford the taxes and transfers and the social welfare programs that kind of undergird it, right? So this is sort of in my model of varieties of capitalism, how I subdivide or how I distinguish between social democracy and democratic socialism, right? So I think what people are saying in America, like what Ocasio-Cortez and what Bernie Sanders say when they call themselves socialists, they're really social democrats.
Yep.
And the Democratic Socialists for America contains many, many democratic socialists, but they're in this uneasy relationship where they have, you know, they have a lot of vowels and consonants in common, but but they're actually they're actually not the same viewpoint. And the analogy that I like to give comes from Thomas Schelling, and Thomas Schelling has this thought experiment in Choice and Consequences, one of his old books. It's been called the Titanic Paradox or the Titanic Puzzle, and it's kind of apocryphal, but the idea is that when the Titanic sank, people in the third class and the working class people on the boat didn't get lifeboats because part of the ticket price, they had like a reduced ticket price, and part of the trade-off was, we're not going to put in lifeboats for you. We're just going to put in lifeboats for the first and second class. So if you were in carriage, you drowned. And that sets off a lot of like internal egalitarian instincts in people where it's like, well, that's a major inequity. But then Schelling points out, we don't really have the same intuitions when people buy tickets on different boats with different levels of safety at different prices. So there's a kind of like an intuition that within the firm power dynamic, so to speak. And then there's like a between firm power dynamic. This is how I sort of think about the distinction is a democratic socialist and, you know, socialists more broadly are concerned about power hierarchies at every fractal level of society. And that includes like hierarchies within a firm. So they want to flatten those hierarchies. Whereas a social democrat sort of looks at that as through the lens of the Titanic paradox and says, well, you could have a very flat firm over here and a very flat firm over there, but those two firms could be very different. And so there's inequalities between firms. So why is that acceptable, but the inequality within a firm isn't? And the more social democratic model is like, well, actually there's some big benefits to having inequities within a firm because like corporations that are run hierarchically are often better run. It's sometimes useful to have management that has, you know, different interests from workers and And that's partly why you can have the productive economy that later goes and equalizes people after the fact. What are your thoughts on that as a scholar of multinational?
So, I would draw the distinction differently. And I do think it's really about, for me, the distinction is really about ownership. I think that sort of social democrats identify the problems of kind of both income and wealth inequality and the like political and social inequalities that arise from that, which are a big part of this. This is not just an economic debate, right? This is about, we care about inequality because it has like widespread social and political consequences, as kind of problems of distribution. And that doesn't just mean redistribution, right? It also means kind of like preemptive interventions in the economy, in the way that firms are organized, in the way that they're regulated, in the way that salaries are negotiated, in, you know, sort of the rights that are given to the labor. But all of those things are designed to address kind of the distribution of resources. They're not designed to address like ownership of production. And I think that's a very specific thing that, like, if you're concerned about that and making interventions in that, then you might be a socialist. So democratic socialists are people who would like to make those interventions democratically. That's really all it means, mm-hmm. right? It's a distinction between, I'm not doing this with jackboots, I'm gonna like make proposals and people are gonna vote for them and stuff. But what I think, you know, I'm not sure that it's like, it's so much about the degree of intervention that you want to make. I mean, the Nordic states make very granular interventions, both, you know, both outside of the firm and within kind of employment situations.
But they're not quite like a participatory co-op managed, you know.
Sure. I mean, there's stuff like that, but it's also kind of, very, very widespread, very, very widespread unionization, which means that sectors that in other countries maybe like wouldn't have collective bargaining agreements do, and that affects kind of the wage packages that people are getting. But then there's a feedback loop between that and the welfare state, because if you're going to tax people at the levels that you need to maintain this kind of welfare state, you don't just tax the very wealthy. In order for it to work, right, you have to have pretty high levels of taxation, even at the middle income level, and people need to be earning pretty decent wages for that to work. So I think it really is very much about kind of like this very traditional ownership of the means of production, to kind of borrow the Marxist language there. And I do think that in that way, the term democratic socialist is being kind of clumsily applied in the US. But what I also think is confusing, and this is, so we've been talking about how Americans are dumb. They use all these terms badly, right? But actually, I'm now gonna crap on Europeans a little bit, because one of the reasons that this is confusing is that American progressives, kind of naturally looking at Western Europe and going, some of these countries have clearly figured out how to run, you know, market economies where they have large successful corporations everybody knows that like German business produces awesome stuff. And yet kind of have lower levels of inequality. Okay, how are they doing it? What can we borrow? We'll find that actually the political parties across Europe don't always use these terms in a consistent way. So I spent 5 years living in the UK. Officially, the Labour Party is a democratic socialist party. It is currently run by some people who really think it should be a democratic socialist party. But for long periods of time, and I don't just mean the Blair years, which to some extent are like a real aberration, but through most of kind of the 20th century, for long periods of time, it was run by people who considered that to be just a semantic thing and treated labor very much as though it was kind of a social democratic party. And then there are parties, you know, kind of elsewhere in Europe. I mean, the sort of like Norwegian social democrats are clearly, you know, have helped to bring that country to a place where it has like elements of real democratic socialism, in the sense that there are, you know, these kind of wealth funds and there is state ownership of certain parts of industry, and yet they call themselves social democrats. So to some extent, I think a lot of even within Europe, like these terms are a little bit fuzzy. I think kind of like academics try to give them some kind of rigor that they may not actually have in the world, which is just a general statement about how academics do social science research, because people are fuzzy and messy and so on. I think the place where the distinction is maybe clearest, and to some extent where the terms come from, is in the German context, where kind of German social democrats have always identified very explicitly as like not socialists.
Right.
And that has kind of particular roots in like the kind of the early part of the 20th century and the run up to kind of fascism and the degree to which the far German left, which was kind of socialist communist, had, you know, certain views about like the relative priorities of like achieving the socialist revolution and fighting fascism. And the social democrats were the people who were sort of saying, look, these guys are dangerous in ways that regular conservatives are not dangerous. And so, you know, we all fall in a broad coalition of the, from the center left to the communists and try and vote against them. And that didn't happen. And that's sort of the story of the 1932 election. But it, so that, that split, I think, has like very particular roots in Germany that I'm not sure are necessarily true in like the actual party politics of sort of the various left of center political parties.
Sure. I mean, Germany had a very, there was something that happened in the early 20th century in Germany.
Yeah, that might be unique.
And you know, Konrad Adenauer, the first chancellor, post-war chancellor. Like, I used to be obsessed with like ordo-liberalism, right? And there's like a journal, Ordo Journal.
You've matured nicely.
And the idea there was that there's like this third way, right? And there's a social market economy that tries to blend the best of both and is also rooted in, you know, Christian social doctrine, which, you know, I think there were some encyclicals back then that like from the church that were like, capitalism is great. We need capitalism. Property rights are great, but we also need subsidiarity, and we also need, you know, to decommodify aspects of the economy from a Christian point of view. And it's interesting. Some of the more prominent thinkers in the U.S. these days, like Elizabeth Brunig, are sort of revitalizing some of the Christian socialist roots of that thinking. And it's a point I also made in the context of like, I wrote a piece recently about Hungary and their pronatalist policies. And a lot of it actually dates back to the 1960s under the Soviets, where like there was a laxity around, you know, women's work and stuff like that. So these things all have kind of deep roots. The one thing that I would push back on your point about ownership is, so there's just right now, there's just like intra left debate about the utility of a sovereign wealth fund, right? Matt Brunig at the People's Policy Project has a proposal for a social wealth fund modeled kind of, and at least inspired after Norway's. Norway, like you mentioned, is unique because it is a country of about 5 million and it stumbled on one of the biggest oil reserves. And, you know, they need a social wealth fund for macroeconomic reasons. Right. And it can be a bit misleading because, you know, in his paper, he'll say, you know, Norway has, you know, nationalized 60 or 70% of the wealth of the country. But that's because there's a huge natural resource underneath the North Sea. When you look at it at the level of employment, I think only about 10% of Norwegian workers actually work in like state-run enterprises. So that's the first point. The second point is that there's this debate, like, so he proposes, you know, we don't have like big oil reserves to buy up. I mean, so he kind of proposes buying up, you know, the stock market, equities, private property. It's actually sort of modeled also on the Swedish, the Swedish idea around I forget what it was called, a wage earner fund or something like that, where they, you know, the social democrats,
In the 70s. I mean, they're probably actually much, they're probably really for Americans, they're very close to pension funds. They're just bigger and you get money out of them your whole adult life rather than just, when you retire. Right. But that's, I mean, that's basically what they are.
And so if you think about it, like if ownership is what's key, then, you know, it makes sense. So let's start a wealth fund that's managed by the government and have it buy up, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ and buy up, all the major, you know, buy up all the major producers just slowly piecemeal by piecemeal 5% a year, something like that. And then eventually you have like a public, you have public ownership over the means of production where we're owning over 50% of the companies. Now in Norway's case, with some exceptions, they try to limit ownership stakes to like a non-controlling share, even though they do you know, exercise control. So that got some pushback from, Mike Consul at the Roosevelt Institute, who noted, you know, what happens when people, when a broad swath of society are like getting dividend checks based on the performance of, you know, Fortune 100 companies? Are they going to demand better worker rights in those companies, or are they going to push those companies to, pay out bigger dividends?
So, right, right. So this goes to actually a thing. I mean, I know this is about the social wealth fund, but to some extent, this goes to some of the research that has been done about like co-determination models. So co-determination for people who are listening, right, is when workers have elected representatives on corporate boards, which is not the same thing as workers having actual share ownership of the company. There's just an extra, the shareholders have the total amount of shares, they elect their representatives, and then there's a separate set of seats that are reserved for workers to elect their representatives. And one of the things that like has come out in the research into that, especially in Sweden, and there is a paper that, I mean, where there's like the links below the video, I'm happy to share this, that some colleagues at a Swedish university did. Basically, over time, the worker representatives start to vote pretty much the same as the like regular shareholder representatives, because they're all sitting in the same conference room and they get to know each other, and they become, to some extent, you know, like a Marxist would say, they become part of that class of people, right?
They're co-opted.
And the kind of cultural, like, assimilation that takes place in the boardroom and at the corporate retreats at a certain point means that there's not, you know, that much difference. I mean, that paper still found that there were some other benefits to having this model. But I think, like, to some extent, this idea of, like, a wealth fund that's based on share ownership of companies, like, why would you assume that you and I would be different kinds of shareholders than, like, the people who are already shareholders with our small stakes? And that, like, for me is one of the major problems with sort of, like, trying to do this from within the shareholder model. The government holding all those stakes is different, right? But it places a lot of trust in the state, and the ability of the state to, you know, kind of make those decisions. And there's a reason that, in fact, none of the countries and none of the places that are ostensibly the inspiration for that, that social wealth fund proposal actually have that. So that even Norway, as you say, has very high levels of ownership, but that ownership is of this natural resource. In practice, doesn't actually mean that most people are working.
And actually, it's, you know, largely stuff that's not oil is mostly foreign companies, right?
Yeah, or it's, I mean, or it's tech. Or it's tech, and you know, and that's true in a lot of Scandinavian countries, that like a lot of the entrepreneurship, that's where it's happening. But so, yeah, I'm very skeptical of the idea that, like, if you actually turn this into, like, everybody becomes a shareholder. One of the reasons for that is it's kind of ironic to see that put forward by, like, somebody who imagines himself on the left, because one of the ways that people on the right, when I was young, used to say, like, it, you know, everything's going to be fine and we're all going to have a say in, like, the control of this boom economy that's developing in the 90s, is that everybody's a shareholder now. It's so great that we, like, converted your pension from a real pension where you get a fixed amount into, like, some stocks that you own, because now you can participate. And I think one of the things that lots of pension holders learned, you know, in the 2000s, right, is that, no, you can't, because the person who's, like, a real investor who's wealthy and has tons of shares and, you know, owns a big fund and whatever, has a computer that does the trading for them. And there is, you can watch as much Jim Cramer on TV as you want, you will never be able to pick stocks competitively with a computer. So that is not a real model for people to exercise kind of meaningful control in the economy. But it was such a weird, it was also just like a bizarre proposal, you know, sort of from the left, because in some ways it's very radical, but in some ways it's not, because it's kind of accepting that, like, this is how corporations work, the answer to shareholders, and, like, in order for us to do anything about this, we must become shareholders. And I don't know if this makes me more or less radical than Mac Bruning, but my initial reaction is to say, why do corporations have to work that way?
Right. Well, I think that's where I become more of a sympathetic to Matt's view, because like I have a view of like the welfare state as kind of like the state as mutual insurance cooperative or something like that. Where like a mutual co-op, you know, there's lots of, you can buy insurance in the private sector from co-ops, and there's a certain logic to that model for insurance. And it turns out there's like scales to efficiency. Efficiency to scale. And so it just makes sense to run a lot of insurance programs at the state level. That's my view. And I think that's kind of totally consistent with like a liberal view of society.
Sure.
And his view, I think you make a really good point saying that this has echoes of like, we're all shareholders now. Because, you know, there's this debate about like, what is private property, what is public property? Because obviously all private property is like co-constitutive with the state giving it, you know, enforcing it and so on. The only country that comes close to like the Norwegian model, first of all, there aren't really many other countries that have like successfully run sovereign wealth funds other than like the Saudis, I guess.
But they don't run them as social wealth funds, right? I mean, like, of course, yeah, they have them, right? And they... Mm-hmm. They use them to buy airlines and soccer teams.
And they're like their own model. They're just rentier states, right? And then the one exception I think I can think of is like Singapore. And Singapore is another like extremely technocratically well-run country. But it's also ironically like a model for the reactionary right.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's a repressive place, right? And I mean, and sure. You know, sort of, so it's not a liberal state at all. And in that sense, I mean, the Scandinavians that are doing this in a much, much more liberal way.
Sure. I think part of the illiberalism of Singapore is like sort of, can be separated from like the fact that their parliament is like one party rule and so on. Like you could imagine a more liberal Singapore that still, so yeah. The way I think about Singapore is it's blurring the lines between public and private, because, you know, they'll point out that, you know, Singapore ranks highly on the Economic Freedom Index, but at the same time, like 80% of their housing is socially owned and publicly owned. But that's because Singapore is run as a city state, is run like it's its own corporation. It's like a company town. It was like founded as a trading post to the East Indies.
So this is corporate
feudalism, right?
Right. But the thing about that is that that's not that rare. So I mean, that's what I study. I study company towns, basically, and the governance of them and, you know, kind of what the implications are of having like your employer provide everything for you. For long periods of time, that was just the normal way that corporations were run. There is like a group of people, who kind of work on the early history of like the corporation as a thing, who are pretty clear that like the corporation itself like makes this distinction between public and private very problematic, because initially when corporations were created, all corporations had public charters, and not just the ones that like we're familiar with, like the colonial trading corporations, but even like kind of domestic corporations would have, would be authorized to exist under laws that gave them some public obligations that would be separate from their kind of shareholder obligations. Because of that, like issues around property and around taxation and around, you know, various issues that arise in the regulation of corporations would sit somewhere between kind of the public and private sector. And so the idea of like the business corporation is very much like a private thing that is actually owned by its shareholders is a very recent idea in corporate law, and B, something that lots of corporate legal academics think is basically hogwash. And so this is something that's like very much contested in terms of like the actual law and the theoretical understanding of it. And so because of that, you know, a place like Singapore, yeah, it's kind of a company town that becomes a state. Like that's, I don't actually think that's that anomalous. I think that that's what of the early history of the corporation looks like. But then once you kind of, I like to think about that because it makes kind of contemporary cases that I'm looking at where people go, oh, like this town, you know, in India is so weird. This company like provides everything. And I'm going, well, maybe it's not that weird. Maybe it's just how it's always been. But it also means that like, I don't, I don't react really in any particular way to the idea that the corporation could be organized in such a way that sort of shareholder ownership isn't its only governing principle. Because in the long history of the corporation, there have been centuries where it's been organized that way. And the way that you and I know it, in, you know, kind of a North American context, is like a small piece of the history of the corporation as a form.
Right.
And lots of those places where it was organized differently were market capitalist societies. I mean, 19th century London was a market capitalist mm-hmm. society in which all of its corporations had kind of dual, like, reporting responsibilities, where you would have certain accounts that you would file for your shareholders and certain obligations to your shareholders, and then, like, a totally separate relationship with, like, a parliamentary committee that would be responsible for ensuring that you met your charter obligations.
Sure. I mean, I'm Canadian. We at the Hudson Bay Company, and But and I agree with you that they're more, way more common than people realize, and that's actually kind of my point. Is like post Enlightenment and post, you know, Westphalia Treaty, whatever. Like, there's this like theory of democracies as like this distinctive, at least normatively distinctive entity, but like, if you read the neo-reactionaries, they're like, oh, we like Singapore because it's the closest thing to a modern absolute monarchy. It's like Frederick the Great. It's like running a perfectly run country. And then, you know, think about the countries we've been talking about, like Norway and Denmark, and the Nordics sort of avoided the feudalism of continental Europe, and partly because they were more centralized and had, you know, strong monarchies. And, you know, they've since, you know, democratized, but they're still constitutional monarchies, and they still had that legacy of relatively central control being run as if there's like this Norway Inc. and Norway has, and so this is my galaxy brain idea that like Matt Brunig and the neo-reactionaries meet in the same place.
I mean, yeah.
The neo-reactionaries will say, well, we want society to be run for the nobility, right?
Right.
And so, Matt Brunig is just saying, we agree, and we just want to, like, have more people be nobility.
I mean, that's not the way that he thinks he's doing it, but that is in practice, you know, what that kind of proposal tends to mean. I think that's right, but that's sort of, but that's why I actually think, although in, like, a really narrow way, the Brunig proposal is being sold as like more socialist because it involves like interventions in ownership in this way. The much more radical proposal is the Warren one.
I agree.
You know, that's the proposal that I think that is kind of the refusing to accept like the legitimacy of the shareholder model as like the only thing that corporations should be bound by. And as somebody who thinks that like this 30 or 40 year period during which Western corporations have assumed that they just respond to shareholders is A, an aberration, and B, maybe not a good one. Like I am intrigued by that. I'm not 100% sure that her proposal is going to work. And I have, you know, I have concerns about implementation and concerns about what the impact would be. But I think that like in asking the questions about the actual governance of corporations, and not just about like the redistribution of money, not just about the ownership of shares, but about how are the decisions about how the corporation will be run, about who will be hired, about what they'll be paid, about what we'll be actually doing, what are we going to make, what kind of cars are we going to make, and why are we going to make them? Like trying to actually probe how those decisions are made and reform those decisions, like that to me is actually kind of radical progressive policy.
Yeah, I mean, I 100% agree. And that's why I wrote a piece fiercely opposing the Warren bill. You know, it's funny, like come full circle a bit, but Will Wilkinson is much more sympathetic to the Warren proposal because he does have a more like, it's funny, Will was like an objectivist in the 90s and like let that go, whereas I was never an objectivist, but now I'm becoming sort of more sympathetic to like the need for like adventurous leaders, I guess. Or like, and maybe this is just like Silicon Valley ideology or something like that. But so we had like this opportunity to come in and talk to a Warren staff, the staffer that wrote the bill. And, you know, they're not like, Warren, for what it's worth, is not committed to like any one version of this bill.
No, I agree. Right. They're trying something out, and I kind of admire that.
Mm-hmm. And they're putting it out there to differentiate too, you know, clearly planning a presidential run and differentiating from the Bernie wing. But it's weird. Like Bernie, like there's this kind of like, there's this kind of like inversion where Bernie is proposing, you know, society have, you know, more tax and transfers and calling himself a socialist, where Warren wants to upend the corporate governance model and the granular structures of capitalism in America. And, you know, gives interviews where she says, I'm 100% a capitalist through
right.
I just care about, you know, referees.
Right. Right. And I mean, but I think she is, right? I mean, sure. Like with, you know, to the extent that like Germany is a capitalist country, which it is, and which is like very obviously kind of, you know, the place that's like most associated with this form of codetermination. And I think Austria for a while had something similar. I can't remember now if they still do. And then certainly some of the Scandinavian countries have kind of milder versions of it. And you know, what I'll say is, I think because it's really intervening in kind of decision-making, what I like about it is it's much more likely to get at, like, the roots of inequality in the U.S. are not just about kind of the availability of jobs, and wages. And wages, you know, are like real wages are falling for lots of people. That's true. But it's also about, you know, sort of the nature of the kind of work that people have available to them. A transition from an economy in which lots of people have kind of steady full-time work to an economy in which lots of people are on functional contracts. And that, you know, has huge implications for how you organize households. Lots of those kinds of decisions are really like policy decisions that companies are making internally about business strategy. And they're very, very hard to like regulate. Mm-hmm. But they are decisions that if you are in the room, making kind of infirm decisions about how a corporation is organized, you can have an impact on. And for me, that's kind of the promise of it, right? That does it have some ability to, you know, to enable workers to check kind of like the headlong rush towards zero-hour contracts or something like that. And I don't know, but I think that's kind of where some of its potential is. What I find concerning about it, and this is something that I think has come up in the countries that already have it, and certainly this is true, in Germany is, and there is, you know, there's research about this, is a lot of these companies, you know, whether they're Volkswagen or Siemens or like any of the big, you know, German companies that we all know, they're very globalized. And because the way that these laws are written, you know, you have to meet the threshold, whether it's 100 employees or 500 employees or whatever, you know, kind of differs based on the country. You meet the threshold of employees in country, mm-hmm. and it's employees in country that like elect representatives to your board. But if you have a lot of subsidiaries abroad, or you have a lot of subcontractors abroad, there's no really easy way for the German government to mandate that those people have like get to vote for representatives on the board of your German parent corporation.
Right.
That like international voting would create a whole bunch of like global governance issues that like nobody's ever tried to actually, do that. But then if you have kind of all the German workers of your factories are represented on your board, it's very easy for them to say, okay, these forms of exploitation that go beyond kind of wage and hour rules, but stuff about working conditions and stuff about, you know, kind of benefits associated with your job and so on, we're not going to allow that in the German factories. But nobody's actually going to stand up for not allowing that in your factory in Bangladesh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. Volkswagen tried to
necessarily make these companies more ethical from a global, like, CSR perspective, even right. if it means they do tend to treat their workers, and that has kind of, you know, better, and that has ancillary benefits for like the workers' families and kind of like working people generally in the country where these kinds of corporations are based. There's not a lot of evidence that it makes life better if you work for a Volkswagen supplier in another country. And because most of the corporations that we are talking about who engage in bad behavior that we're concerned about, whether it's, you know, kind of run a plaza factory fire or whatever, most of that is happening somewhere down the supply chain. Mm-hmm. And this kind of proposal doesn't really offer you know, a way to deal with that. And when you talk to, and I, you know, as part of my research, I talk all the time to kind of labor leaders, certainly labor leaders in developed countries who advocate for this kind of proposal. And so, for example, a lot of British labor unions have advocated for something like this in the UK, will say, yeah, you know, if we think about it hard, globalization is ungovernable and we like can't help those people. And we would just prefer that the jobs came home, right? Deep down inside, that's kind of, that's what they want. And I kind of understand it, but I also feel like it used to be a tenet of the left that the left was meant to be international. And I think we're like called to some higher challenge to, there has to be a way to do this that actually like delivers those benefits for the workers who are the most vulnerable. So it's, I'm skeptical of co-determination in the sense that I don't think it'll go far enough. You know, I think it's probably worth trying. But I am not sure that it will go far enough. And certainly with American companies that like already have a lot of their production outsourced, I think you could see companies kind of dealing with it, by like offloading some of the most exploitative practices, into subsidiaries that wouldn't necessarily be covered by this. So you would have to link it. And this, I was surprised, was not in her proposal because it is floating around, in left-leaning policy circles with some kind of legislation that makes parent companies more responsible for their supply chain. And that there probably ought to be anyway, because it is very clear that a lot of corporations are using it kind of explicitly as buck passing. And, you know, sort of like alien torts clearly didn't work out and there were reasons that that didn't work out, but there probably are ways through like regular legislation to raise kind of the due diligence requirements that you would expect an American company to carry out on its foreign suppliers.
Yeah, I mean, there are, some countries have taken steps to that, and like the Norwegian wealth fund doesn't invest in tobacco companies, for example, and they have a host of other like ethical lines that they draw. But I think there is like this downstream, again, parochialism of some socialist or social democratic policy where it is, to the extent that it is trying to maximize for, you know, Sweden Inc., that it cares about the workers of Sweden Inc. at the expense of workers abroad. And that, to be fair, you know, that is a kind of cosmopolitan view that I would share, like that the people outside the borders matter, which is also, but not necessarily like, not necessarily going to feature prominently in any presidential nominee's domestic agenda, right?
No, it's, I mean, it's not, right? And there's, I mean, that's, but that is the problem. So that's what, when labor leaders say like globalization is ungovernable, I kind of understand what they mean, and that there's no way to like bring those concerns into a, like a democratic forum because our democracies are based on national electorates, and on, you know, things that the nation has to consent to. And it's very, very hard to ask workers in any country to consent to something that they perceive, even in the short term, as like limiting their interests if it benefits people elsewhere. And global democracy is not a thing that A is going to happen or that anybody is advocating, right?
So, except for rubber.
So it is a problem. It is a problem. And, you know, I do think that there are like things that you can do at the kind of international level, that would make some difference. But it is, you know, it's kind of a tension. I also think that like, it's one of the frustrations that I have about kind of, both to some extent, kind of democratic socialist and social democratic flavors of left political economy in Europe. And I think I can see some of this happening with some of what's happening in the States, although it's hard because I'm seeing it from here and I can't ever tell. Twitter is not accurately representative of anything. But, you know, that as people start to realize that these dynamics kind of exist and that you can only really govern what's happening within your own borders, you know, there is a tendency, I think, for certain forms of left political economy to develop strains of xenophobia that aren't about, like, we don't want the people, but they become about, like, we don't want this interaction with these other economies because we don't know how to govern that and we can't figure out how to govern that. And look, most often that manifests in kind of straightforward protectionism, but there's also, I think, a degree to which, like even some of these kind of milder labor reforms, you know, there's like a desire to kind of bracket out these workers abroad. And I think you also see it a little bit with welfare state politics in that in order to like sustain kind of the high levels of taxation that are associated with, generous welfare states, people need to have like some sense that they can picture who the beneficiary is.
Right.
And the more the beneficiary, they start to imagine that that person is different from them, the harder it becomes. This is one of these things that like when I teach comparative welfare states, varieties of capitalism is very, very helpful in that people, you know, British students will ask you, right, why is the American welfare state so much less generous than the British one? And the honest answer is a big part of that is race. And a big part of that is that, like, the degree to which in a racially divided, very diverse country, if more affluent people skew white, they find it kind of psychologically difficult to, like, imagine that they want to be generous to a welfare state that they imagine is going to benefit people who are different from them. So there is a danger, I think, that some of this welfare state politics and even some of these kind of corporate governance reform politics can kind of skew in that direction. And trying to find ways, and this is probably the part of my politics, like in other ways I'm pretty kind of very mainstream European social democrat, but the strain of liberalism that remains in my politics is the desire to find some way for these like these gains to be like globally universal,
right?
And that like the right to not work in a factory that's going to collapse, like that seems like a universal human right to me, and I would like for the left to be developing policy solutions that deliver that. And sometimes I worry that the solutions we have are much more likely to kind of hold those gains for ourselves and hope that, you know, the Nike sweatshops remain out of sight, out of mind.
Right. In other words, we are giving lifeboats to the third class on our Titanic, but letting other ships sink.
Right. No, that's right. That's right. And lots of people will go, well, it's terrible. You know, I read about that. But I don't understand what we can do about it. It's too hard a problem. And I think certainly with progressives, like very few of them will say, oh, I don't care, openly. But they will say it's too difficult and I'm like not willing to spend political capital on it because there's no political capital to be gained, from spending on it. And that's, you know, the postdoctoral project that I'm starting now is supposed to be trying to figure out if there's some way at the international level, but with democratic consent at the national level, to do something about that.
Well, race in the welfare state, and I think immigration also ties into that too, is a whole can of worms, and I think we're all already running over time. So
absolutely.
This has been great. Good to see you again.
Yeah, you too. I hope this was, I hope this was fruitful, and wave to everybody in blogging hesitation.
Bye.
Bye.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.